Welcome to Funny Story Live. I'm Annalise Griffin, editor-in-chief of Brooklyn-based. Each month we collaborate on a storytelling show at Brooklyn Brewery with Tom Shalhoub, one of our favorite comedians and storytellers. There are no rules and no themes, but there is plenty of beer. Think of it like we do, like a sloppy, laid-back version of The Moth. This month's podcast combines stories from a few different shows, and the settings range from New York City to Secaucus, New Jersey, to Istanbul. Here's Tom to get things started.
We have a great little crowd here tonight. Sometimes in the winter months, you know, people get scared because they think, oh, it's cold and I'm not going to go out and, you know, hear stories. I mean, but we're here. That's great. The year was 1999. That's a dramatic year, isn't it? Do you remember 1999? Yes, the Y2. Remember the Y2K bug? We were all worried about it. Some of the young people don't remember what it was like in the late 90s. There was a dot-com boom. Everyone was cashing in their stock options. Everyone was making like $100,000 a week. You don't know what it was like back then. It was the promise of the new century. And I was just getting a foothold in the world of comedy. You know, I never thought I would be a comedian, but then I got to New York and I ended up spending a decade trying to break into the business, you know, clawing my way to the top or to right here. Wherever this is that I'm at, clawing my way there. But that's the thing about it is no matter what level you get in show business, you claw your way to get there. You know, I had gotten to the city and I was running around and doing, you know, it took me 2 years to get into the real open mic nights, you know, like playing it at night. The other ones were open mic afternoons. And I was finally getting on at the open mic nights and the new talent night. I was playing new talent night at Caroline's Comedy Club. You don't understand that. Monday night at Caroline's, that was a real show. It was a real show. It was booked and you came and you played to a whole room and you made a videotape and you submitted that videotape to the, you didn't really do anything with it, but you always thought you were going to submit it somewhere, but then you thought, no, I'll wait one more tape. But in the late 90s, I was just getting going. I had quit my waiting job. I was working on a show. I got a pilot. Pilot. I had always wanted a pilot, and they had come to New York City, and they were looking for sketch comedians. Now, this was a few years before 99. This is when my first break in the business. I went to an audition. This show was going to compete with Saturday Night Live. They wanted a multicultural troupe of sketch comedians. And I don't know if you remember in the 90s, that show, In Living Color, it was taking on Saturday Night Live. It was kind of an urban. It had an urban feel to it. You know what I mean by urban? You know what I mean by urban? Everyone was black except Jim Carrey. That's what I mean. So they were wanting to do a multicultural show, and they said, we're going to take on SNL in their time slot. That's what we're after. And so I went to the audition, and they were seeing everybody. I don't want to say that, I don't want to make fun of the show, which I am going to do, but they had a foundation and they wanted to create racial harmony throughout the United States, and they thought, we're going to do it through television. And what better way to get to people's hearts than through the art of comedy? So that was the idea of the show. Sounds great from the very beginning, doesn't it? So I quit my job. I was like, the show was called What's Up. What's up? It was like, you know, they wanted all the races, like, what's up? I call it What's Up. It wasn't really What's Up. It was What's Up. But I, you know, when I tell the story, I'm going to say, what's up? Because it seems that's better. That's a better title, I think. So I was on, what's up? And I went back to my job at the Museum Cafe, and I was like, I'm leaving. I got a pilot. Dude, what's up to you? You know, so I left my job. Meanwhile, the pay was like $610 for the whole thing. But that got me through, you know? So I quit the job, and I did the pilot. One of the things we did, we sat around in a circle And they had the cameraman come in, and he was like, okay, everyone sit around in a circle. And it was like kind of like a corporate retreat kind of thing where you sit around in a circle. And the cameraman got down in front of us, and he went around in a circle, and they said, now we're going to tell our firsthand experiences with prejudice, okay? This isn't writing. This is just you talking from the heart, your firsthand experiences with prejudice. So they're going, and they got the black guy, and he was like, yo, when I go into a store, you know, with my posse or whatever. I don't know if they had posses back then, but they, you know, I go in with my posse, and the security guard always looks at me like, hey, can I help you? You know, and it's like, no, you can't help me, you know. So he had his story. And then the Indian woman was like, you know, I live in a doorman building, and I get on the elevator, and they're like, oh, are you the nanny? It's like, no, I'm not the nanny. It's like, oh, wow, you know. So she had her thing. And then the Asian guy was like, oh, you know, everyone thinks I'm good at math. I'm not that good at math. Oh, you know what? Everyone had their cross to bear, you know. And then it got to me, like, I was just absorbed in everyone's stories. I was like, oh, wow, oh, black guy, oh, Asian guy, whatever. And then the camera finally gets to me. I remember the lens just, like, goes right on me, and I hadn't prepared a story. Like, so I just looked at the lens, and I was like, so far, no problems. That was from the heart. Let's get some other stories going. Let's welcome Dave Koenig.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for having me here. I should say this is the first time I've been in Williamsburg in 25 years. The only other time I've ever been in Williamsburg was 25 years ago, and it's obviously it's changed quite a bit. And frankly, I'm not really sure I'm on board with all the changes. I went before the show. I was hungry, and I went to the restaurant across the street to get a burger and a Coke. And I asked the waiter where the men's room was, and he directed me to the men's room, which turned out to be a unisex bathroom, which is just an abhorrent concept and should not be allowed under any circumstances. And then I just wanted a Diet Coke, and they tried to sell me some kind of free range, organic Mexican Paraguayan free trade cola that was just. So I'm a little, you know, I don't know about Williamsburg. But I'm here because a few years ago, I was booked to do my stand-up act at a show in a Spanish restaurant in Secaucus, New Jersey, for just very, very bad money. Not like the fortune I'm making tonight here, but. And there was nothing about the prospect of this show that boded for a particularly good evening of entertainment. It was a stand-up show in a Spanish restaurant in Secaucus for terrible money. But I drove out there to do the show anyway, because essentially performers we're all addicts. We're all addicted to this. So we will drive to Secaucus for a lousy show, and we will get up in front of an audience, and we will do this. So I'm driving to Secaucus, and I get to the town of Secaucus, New Jersey, and I start making my way to the restaurant where the show was, which was not easy on this particular night, because the entire town of Secaucus was under martial law. There were police and firemen everywhere, and you couldn't navigate anything. So I parked the car, I started making my way towards the restaurant, and as I got closer to the venue, I saw that the entire restaurant was completely surrounded with police tape. No one could get into the place. And as I approached the restaurant, the producer of the show was standing outside and just chain smoking and shaking his head. So I went up to him naturally, and I asked him what had happened. And this is what happened. Just a few minutes prior to this, it's now almost 8 o'clock showtime, and just a few minutes prior to that, directly across the street from the restaurant, a man was sitting on a bench waiting for a bus. Simultaneously, right up the block from the bus stop, an old lady who should not have been driving was driving. Now, it's unclear what happened next, but either she really, really hated that bus stop, or she got confused and stepped on the gas when she should have stepped on the brakes. But either way, she plowed directly into the bus stop, removing the man's head completely from his body and killing him instantly. Aside from that, he was okay. So naturally, given the circumstances, I assumed that the show would be canceled. I'm a firm believer in the adage, the show must go on. But in this particular case, perhaps it probably should have been amended to the show must go on unless the show is in Secaucus and there's no audience and a man has just lost his head. In that case, the show should probably be canceled. So I went up to the producer and I said to him, I said, look, I understand it's a very unusual circumstance. It's okay. You don't have to pay me. We can reschedule this. I'll come back some other time. The producer took a deep drag from his cigarette, turned and looked at me, and he said, let's just give it a little bit more time. Maybe they'll take the police tape down. What could I say? I mean, this guy had just uttered the most heartbreaking line I have ever heard in show business. This is a line that so completely encompasses everything that show business is all about. Desperate hope. Heavily laden with hopeless desperation. Let's just give it a little bit more time. Maybe they'll take the police tape down. This is a line that should be emblazoned over the entrance of every theater in America. Now, clearly, this man's optimism, this man's hope, this man had a deep respect for the integrity of theater. And you had to honor that. So we waited. And an hour went by. And then two. And then finally, at 10:30, they took the police tape down. And the producer conned four people into coming in and sitting down and being our audience. And then he announced we were going to do the show. Now, given the circumstances, and there was only four people there, I didn't think it made a hell of a lot of sense to just jump up on stage and start doing my act. So I went and sat with the audience, all four of them, and just started making, small talk. And they were good people, good, solid Secaucus people. And we just chatted a little bit, made some small talk, and then I threw out a line or two and they laughed a little and we laughed and there we were, just sort of laughing and forgetting where we were and what had just happened. And then there was a pause in the conversation. And one of the people, one of the four people, said, gee, it's a shame about the guy who lost his head. And I agreed that, yes, it was a shame about the guy who lost his head. And then we all just kind of looked at our feet for a while. At which point, the producer jumped up on stage and proceeded to do 20 minutes of terrible material. So it turns out that's why he wanted the show to go on, because he wasn't just the producer, he was also the opening act. So he wasn't respectful of the integrity of theater, he was just a bigger addict than I was. He starts doing some aggressively bad crowd work. Hey, where you from? Secaucus? Where you from? Secaucus? There was four people there, they were all from Secaucus. So finally, after just sucking the life out of everyone, he introduced me. So I got up on that stage, and despite the circumstances, or maybe, just maybe because of them, I pulled out all the stops, and I gave those four people the show of my life, and I bombed. Oh, it was awful. But then, I want to tell you, on the way home, on the drive home, I had a realization about the whole evening and about life and death and the whole meaning of everything. And I want to tell you that, but what really happened is I got on the parkway instead of going through the tunnel. I missed my exit. I got lost, and all I really learned was that my GPS hates my guts. but maybe that's the point. Maybe in some way, we're all on the Garden State Parkway, looking for the exit, when all along, all we really had to do was go through the tunnel. Now that's crap. That doesn't make any sense. Here's what I learned from the whole thing. What I learned from this entire evening was we're either living in fear or in faith or in Secaucus. And if you're living in Secaucus, don't take the bus. Thank you very much.
Is that all right?
Awesome. Dave Koenig!
So I like meeting people and then inviting them to do the show and like seeing if I'm right. Like I'm like, this is an interesting person. Let's see if they have a story in them. So this guy has been to the show before. He's an interesting guy. And he told me a story. And I'm like, that is great for my show. And he's like, I'm not a storyteller. I'm like, you are now. And so, you know, he's not a performer, but he's a journalist. He's an interesting guy. And it's a great story. So I asked him to come tell it. So please be kind to this guy. He's like, you know, He's like a newbie, but you know, I know you're gonna show him some love. Peter Lacursey.
So, my story begins in 2010 in the summer, and I had just won a grant to go to Istanbul, Turkey, to learn Turkish as a part of this scholarship from the State Department. And this was like a government initiative where after 9/11, they wanted to send groups of students from all around the United States to these various countries that were important for American foreign policy, like Russia, China, Turkey, Pakistan. And before we went to Turkey, we were flown to DC, where we kind of had this initiation orientation thing. And that's where all of these experts and analysts and people like that gave presentations, and they kind of imbued us with their wisdom. And there were two kind of main points that they kept on reiterating. And the first was, if you're gonna be a good visitor, you're gonna be a good guest in a foreign country, you want to always, when in doubt, defer to your host. And that kind of makes sense. It's like, go with the flow, right? They know what's best. And the second part was, which is kind of a corollary, was say yes to everything. And provided it didn't wind you up in prison, right? Because that's like Midnight Express, you're on your own. And they made that really clear. They were like, we're not gonna risk a diplomatic row with Turkey to get you out of prison for like smoking hash. So that was super clear. But still, you ought to say yes to everything when you can, because even if you get in a messy, weird experience, you're gonna be able to use your language skills and your personality skills to get out of it, and that's gonna be a growth experience for you. Now, the thing is, I took this to heart, because in America, I kind of saw myself as this neurotic, bookish, stay-at-home kind of guy. And in Turkey, I was determined to be an adventurer. I was gonna be like that guy, the Hemingway guy from the beer commercials, the Stay Thirsty. I'm gonna be that guy. And I did. I went to Turkey and I did crazy things. I went to this, I went clubbing with these guys who ended up kind of being mobsters. And I didn't realize that at the time. There's like a whole flesh trade in Turkey. I would like go into tea shops, random tea shops, and hang out with old men and play backgammon, like smoke cigarettes and speak to them. I went to this oil wrestling tournament, which is like when guys get in capri pants, slather themselves in olive oil, and then like get in the mud. And I learned a lot of nuances about masculinity in that way. It was great. And I was adventurous with food. Like I ate, they have these things, this shellfish that they sell, like teenagers sell it on the side of the road. And I ate that shellfish, and that was a stupid mistake. But that's not the point. The point is I said yes. Right? Okay. So, 2 months, 8 weeks into my experience in Turkey, I realized that there was one thing that I didn't say yes to, and that was one of many optional volunteer opportunities on Fridays. The State Department set up these various activities where, like, you could do a dance thing or you could do a singing thing, and one of the more humanitarian ones was that you could go to this orphanage in Kadikoy, which is like a working-class neighborhood in Istanbul, and you could go there and kind of hang out with these young boys who are orphans. And I felt so guilty that I had not done this once. Like, I skipped it every time, and I was doing other things, and it was optional, but still. So the last day that we could, I gathered three friends, and we decided that we would go to this orphanage and take this last opportunity to do something kind of good in a city that had given us a lot of experiences. So that was my intention. We show up at this orphanage, and it's in a beautiful, like, side street. The building's kind of dilapidated, but it's me and my roommate, Niels, who's like a Korean football player, and every morning he used to wake me up at 5 a.m. with, like, his push-up grunts. He was huge. And he would like, Skype with his girlfriend of 3 years. He'd only met her for 11 days. It was crazy. So there was Niels. And then there was Brian, who is this kid from Nashville who spoke Turkish better than anybody in the whole group. And it was because he flirted with girls on message boards in Turkey from Nashville, and he was fluent. It was incredible. It was amazing. And there was also Tyler, who was a University of Minnesota student. He moonlighted as a security guard at his school, but he was kind of dorky. It was really funny. You'd have to know him. But it's great for storytelling. The other thing is that we're big, right? In Turkey, Americans are big. It's just like a thing. Not trying to essentialize, but Americans are, like, tall. A lot of the kids there were, like, Midwestern milk-fed stock. And so we're, like, lumbering 6 flights up this narrow building to meet these orphans in their playroom. And they're, you know, they're, like, around 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And we get there, and the thing is that Istanbul's brutal during the summer. It's 100 degrees and 100% humidity almost the entire time. And it's pretty miserable. So when we got to the 6th floor, they were like, we want out, let's go play soccer. So we kind of turn around, we're sweating and huffing and puffing, of course. I mean, look at me. And when we get to the top, we're about to go back downstairs when this kid, no older than 10, shuffles us in this hallway, in this, like, dark hallway, and what looks like a closet, he kind of opens the door, and it turns out it's an elevator. Now, I don't know what it was. I mean, it could have been that we had spent so much time saying yes and so much time deferring to our hosts that we didn't consider the fact that this is a 10-year-old, that his decision skills might not be up to par, and that he also might be playing a joke on us. But the four of us, these four huge Americans, decide we're gonna just listen to this young boy and go into an elevator in an orphanage in Istanbul. And when I say that this elevator was small and old, it's really hard to, like, overstate. It was so old, it's like Byzantine old. Like Constantinople old. And we fit in, you know, we were, like, crunched in, shoulder to shoulder, back to front, the whole deal. And this kid kind of, bye, and closes the door. And it's pitch black in this elevator. It's out of use. It's like a fucked up elevator. And the kid, like, pushes the button, and all of a sudden, we're going down. And immediately we realize this is the worst mistake that we've ever made. It's like, this is a horror show. And each floor is like a different stage of grief, if grief was terror. So it's like, okay, we get to the 5th floor, and we're kind of nervous laughter, like, holy shit, man, this is a terrible idea. And then the 4th floor, silence. And that's because the mechanisms are struggling so much to keep us afloat that they're making these sounds, these horrible groans, like a herd of dying elephants. And by the time we get to the third floor, it's like we're losing our shit. I call this like the Jesus fucking Christ stage of terror, which even though two of the kids were devout Christians, we're in a chorus of profanity. Like, holy fucking shit, man, this is fucking terrible. And by the time we got to the second floor, we had started to collect our stuff because we realized that we're at least one floor, so we're one floor from the bottom. If it cuts now, we're gonna be okay. I mean, broken legs for sure, but we'll be fine. So we start to align with the first floor, and we're about to like exhale this wonderful relief. Like, we're about to escape grim death. This is awesome. And the elevator aligns with the first floor and then just drops. And the elevator is swinging side to side, and we're like, oh my God, grasping to the thing. It's swinging and hitting all the sides. And where we are now is like, we're submerged into the elevator shaft, and we can look above into the window of the ground floor. But you're definitely not supposed to go below the ground floor. I know that. So immediately, we are very worried, and we start screaming for help. And the first thing that we see is, like a cartoon, head stacked onto the window, and it's these orphans, and they're losing their shit. It's the funniest thing they've ever seen. It's like Americans in a pit being tortured or whatever. So I make eyes with the kid who shuffled us into the elevator, and I've got this suspicion, like, you did this on purpose. And he looks back at me, and he's laughing harder than anybody. And we're trying to keep a brave face because we don't know, you know, it's like, these are young children. We're not supposed to come here and like fuck up their day. We're supposed to come here and be nice. And so we're kind of like, oh, in, again, Turkish, because they don't speak English and we're supposed to be speaking Turkish the whole time. Like, can you please get an adult? Because this is bad. And we try to translate that, and they grab the director of the orphanage. So he comes down. He's pretty lax about everything. He kind of peers in. He seems pretty disappointed, like, oh God. Looking at his watch, goes to his office, grabs the key, right? The manual override or whatever. This is not Star Trek, I'm not sure why I said that. But he takes this key, the manual way of getting the door open, because obviously it's a safety hazard if the which obviously they care a lot about, because the thing is not aligned, right? Someone could fall into the shaft, so it locks automatically unless the car is aligned with the floor. So he's trying that, and he's trying a couple of things, and we're kind of waiting for a response, but we get nothing, and it's clear that that's not working. And then he grabs his cell phone, he gets on the horn, and we can kind of make out what he's saying. He's on the phone with somebody, he's asking them about their mother. Doesn't inspire confidence. And I just want to describe the mood in the elevator for a minute, because, you know, it's 100 degrees outside, okay? It's twice that inside, or at least it feels that way. And it's like four grown men like this in a tiny elevator, and we're worried about our lives. But the mood is kind of like, it vacillates between complete panic and macabre humor. So it's like, holy shit, dude, this is fucking terrible. Why did we do this? Was this your idea? To like, dude, how funny would our obituaries be right now? And this dynamic continues until the guy kind of comes back to the window. You also have to understand, he's up here speaking through thick glass and a metal door in Turkish, a language that we kind of don't understand that well, and it's hard to hear and it's hard to understand. So what we get is that he called the elevator guy, right, the one, I guess, and he turns out to be visiting his mom in the village in rural Turkey, so that's out. And at this point, it's been like 25 minutes in the elevator, and I always thought this was bullshit, but you know, you can run out of oxygen in an elevator. four grown men, no ventilation, 100 degrees, 100% humidity, adrenaline and fear kind of combines with a lot of oxygen intake, and the levels are dissipating. And we know that because the guy Tyler behind me, his knees keep on buckling into mine, and then he hits his head on the back of the thing and his eyes roll, and it's freaky. It's terrible. Like, this guy is passing out. He's in the process of like a slow lapse into unconsciousness. And that's when the panic level kind of rises. By the way, if you're claustrophobic, that's real. You should know that. Like, you can die in an elevator, and I just want you to go forth with that information. Paranoia confirmed. So this guy explains to us that the elevator man is not coming, and we start to freak out because this guy's passing out behind us. And now all deference, all politeness is out the goddamn window. I'm smacking the door with my palm like Thor or something. Like you gotta open this goddamn thing. You gotta do something. Because this guy's dying. I mean, he looks like he's dying. He's blue. And this guy, like this lackadaisical manager of an orphanage, comes over and he kind of peers in. He's like, okay. Disappears for a second. And then shows me a hammer. It's like very esoteric imagery. And I stare up at this hammer, and again, it's hard to make out what he's saying, but he's saying, push to the back. And that doesn't mean anything, because there's no fucking back. And so what this translates into is, okay, we can't do it all at the same time because there's not enough room. So one at a time, let's rotate around, and then there's the back, right? And then we'll just push up against one another, right? And the guy in front of me has the wall in front of him. In order to avoid the glass that's about to break and shatter down upon us, I have to squeeze up against this guy, and we're very sweaty, and it's really humid, and it's kind of like the oil wrestling. But still there's that like humor thing. We're still trying to keep ourselves alive. He's like passing out, but I still went up to him and whispered, how's this for you? And he did respond, good. So he starts like wailing on this glass. Now the problem is the glass has that like lattice chicken wire thing in it to prevent it from shattering, which is great. Because instead of large shards, it's like a hellish rain of small glass shards, and we're like this, and it's getting in our hair, and it's getting on our face, and in our neck, and on our arms. And what's awesome is that because it was so humid, it stuck to our skin, and because we were sweating so much, it just let us bleed profusely. So we're like standing there, like a bad pitch of Saw 5 or whatever. It's like we're trapped in a fucking elevator, bleeding, it just puddles of blood on the floor, sweating, dangling from a wire. But once they crack the window open, things are kind of okay, right? Because the air comes in and they're passing us water and it's gonna be okay. But by the time the firefighters showed, right, it's like 2 or 3 hours. And the whole thing had become mundane by then. We're like flicking pieces of glass off, like trying to hit stuff. The people pass us cell phones, we're drinking, it's fine. And when the firefighters come in, they've got this, they've got their equipment and they're ready for the rescue. And so they approach the elevator and they give us instructions that we don't understand them. And they're using this crowbar, and all four of these huge dudes, they're pushing against the crowbar to try to get the door open, and it does not work. Like, nothing is working. This thing's fucking titanium or whatever. And so they get there, and nothing. Nothing's working. So they kind of whisper, and we can't hear what they're saying, but they bring out this shiny machine. It looks like a chainsaw with pliers in the front of it. And you might know it as the Jaws of Life. And they were super proud of this thing. The Jaws of Life get people out of car wrecks. This is a very serious thing. But they were going to use it on our elevator. And remember, I can't state this enough, close quarters, right? So they're sticking this thing in the window. And they're going to fire it up. And they say again, gather to the back. There is no back. Gather to the back. So we assume the position again. How's this for you? Good. And they fire this thing up, and the sound is crazy, and it rips this door in half like a sheet of paper. And we're free. And so they reach down, and they get us up one by one, and people are applauding. The whole neighborhood came out to watch us get rescued. This is like a thing. This is like a story in local news, one in Istanbul. And people are applauding, and we're shaking the firefighters' hands. They're like, yeah, man. And I look back at this carnage, and like the twisted metal and the blood on the floor and the glass, and I think to myself, like, I came here because I was guilty that I had not come here before. And then I came here and I wreaked havoc on this place. We fucked this place up. An orphanage, nice. And sure, the kids had a hell of a show. Like, they were loving every second of it. They really were. It was unbelievable. Like, great performance. But we ruined their elevator, and we took years off that dude's life, obviously, the watch guy, you know, the director. But we also, you know, we ruined this last ceremonial day where we were going to go play soccer, and everybody, thank you, what a wonderful time. And we ruined that. And, you know, whatever, take what you will about the metaphor for foreign policy in the Middle East, you know, like good intentions, but really fucking thing up. Take what you will. But I kind of thought to myself, looking at the scene, in this case, I probably should have said no. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for Funny Story Live. Come see us the third Thursday of every month at Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.